Now this chapter contains the downfall of Babylon, which was foretold by Daniel as he read the handwriting on the wall at the feast of Belshazzar. Now we have in the first four verses the feast of Belshazzar. Then you have the fingers of God writing upon the wall, verses 5-7. Then you have the failure of the wise men to read the handwriting, and Daniel is summoned from retirement, verses 8-12. And then face to face with the king, Daniel, flattered, rejects the gifts, but agrees to interpret the handwriting, and found wanting, and finis, written over the kingdom of Babylon, is the interpretation. And then, the last 30 and 31, the fall of Babylon, fulfillment that very night. Now, actually, this chapter projects us into the future from the events of the last chapter. A great deal has taken place, and this is just a chapter lifted again out of the historical records of Babylon, and we've moved down a great deal. We open with Belshazzar the king, made a great feast to 1,000 of his lords. He drank wine before the 1,000. Now, that's verse 1 of chapter 5. Now, who was Belshazzar? How did he get on the throne? Last time it was Nebuchadnezzar. Well, in view of the fact that this man Belshazzar has been a controversial figure of history, I think that we ought to just pause just a moment to look at his position in history. Even Dean Farah wrote, there was no such king as Belshazzar. And Sir Herbert Rawlinson has refuted this point of denial, for he found a clay cylinder in the ruins of Chaldea on which the name of Belshazzar was inscribed as the eldest son of Nabonidus. It asserts that he was associated with his father in the latter days of his reign. Now, I think probably we ought to have a resume here of the events that succeeded Nebuchadnezzar, and I think it might be helpful here. You see, at the death of Nebuchadnezzar, his only son, Evil-Merodach, succeeded him to the throne. It was about 561 B.C., and he was murdered by Nergal-Sharezer, who had married one of Nebuchadnezzar's daughters and replaced him on the throne. That was about 559 B.C. And Nergal-Sharezer was succeeded by his young son, who reigned only a few months before he was murdered by Nabonidus. And Nabonidus was the husband of another daughter of Nebuchadnezzar. Now, Nabonidus, the last ruler of the Babylonian Empire, spent much of his reign away from the kingdom on foreign expeditions, and Belshazzar, his son, remained at Babylon as his co-regent. Now, may I say that this reveals how accurate, really, the prophet had been. You remember that Jeremiah, in the 27th chapter, had this to say of Nebuchadnezzar. And I'm reading now, "And now have I given all these lands into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant, and the beasts of the field have I given him also to serve him. And all nations shall serve him, and his son's son, until the very time of his land come, and then many nations and great kings shall serve themselves of him." In other words, the Babylonian kingdom would last through the reign of a son and a grandson of Nebuchadnezzar, and that would end the reign of the Babylonian kingdom as the head of gold. So that we have given to us here the background for this man Belshazzar. And by the way, that was a prayer of Nabonidus to the moon god, for his son was discovered on a clay cylinder. And it reads like this, "My son, the offspring of my heart, might honor his Godhead and not give himself to sin." And Herodotus, the Greek historian, he also mentions this and confirms it. Now, Nabonidus was on the field of battle while Belshazzar, his son, you see, remained in Babylon. And you will notice, and we'll call attention to it when we go through, when Belshazzar offered Daniel a position, it was to be the third ruler in the kingdom. Now, why did he pick that odd number? Why didn't he say, you'll be next to me, second ruler? Because Belshazzar was number two. His father was really the king. And it was during this banquet, or actually before it, that Gobryas, the Persian general, he was outside, and I should say actually the Median general, he was besieging the city from without. Now, Xenophon, the Greek historian, describes how they took the city by detouring a canal of the Euphrates River back into its main channel and then by letting their army flow under the walls of the city. So, friends, this chapter that for many years the critic discounted today is confirmed by secular history. And I don't like to say it that way. I'd rather say that secular history is confirmed by the Word of God, because we do know, even including this historian Herodotus, they were habitual liars. You can't always depend on what they write. But it's interesting to note that we're dealing here with that which is history. Now, we also note here the arrogance of this young upstart Belshazzar. He put on this lavish affair while the armies of Gobryas were in full view of the city. You see, Gobryas was quite an engineer, and he'd moved out because the city of Babylon was a tremendous city, and it was there in the Tigris-Euphrates Valley, actually in the Euphrates Valley, and this city was said to be impregnable. And at least Belshazzar believed it, and he does this very arrogant thing, putting on this banquet. You see, Nebuchadnezzar had built it to withstand any siege. The city wall was 15 miles square. It was constructed of brick. It was 300 feet high and wide enough for four chariots to travel abreast around the city wall. In other words, they could have put a freeway around the top of the city. And he had supplies of grain and water to last for years. In fact, this canal channeled off of the Euphrates River went right through the city. Now, this banquet could have been a defiance to the enemy on the outside. Or perhaps he wanted to build up the morale of those within. And we're told here, it started with a big cocktail party, and liquor today is a temporary prop for weak men and women. Now, some time ago, I made a request to get information from our listeners if they could help me in supplying any figures about the use of alcohol. And I found out that I'm going to ask our listeners for information, because I have received more information on this than I thought that existed. And did you know that today, and I have all of this information right here before me, that alcohol is still the number one drug problem today? It's quite interesting. I thought it was rather ironical and hypocritical. A group of well-meaning citizens of Los Angeles, made up of those in schools and politics and church and all that, they met together to discuss the drug problem among young people. And you know how they opened their meeting? With a cocktail party. Now, how hypocritical can you be? My friend, there are more alcoholics than there are drug addicts, apparently. And you know that 28,400 of the 50,000 killed in traffic accidents each year had alcohol in their blood at the time of the accident? And I've got figures here that are amazing. $21 billion is being spent annually by Americans for alcoholic beverages. And that's according to the Distilled Spirits Institute. May I say to you, the damage that's doing, the wrecks that it's causing, the homes that today are being absolutely wrecked because of alcohol, why, it is something that is alarming. And this liquor problem has been a problem for mankind. And each nation that has gone down has always gone down with liquor. And let's understand, it didn't go down with marijuana. And don't misunderstand me, I'm not for it either. But the point is that I just can't get enthusiastic with all of these reformers today in our government and out of the government who want to solve the drug problem. I say this to them, you give up your cocktail and you let alcohol alone, I'll listen to you. But until then, brother, I don't care for your hypocrisy. May I say to you, old Belshazzar, he started off with a big cocktail party and he got them all high so they'd enjoy the banquet that he was going to put on for them.